Welcome to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cass. Thanks for joining us today. We're talking today about attitudes toward Muslims, and especially what's called Islamophobia, the fear of Islam in the West, past and present and future. 2.5 weeks ago, an armed man named Omar Mateen walked into a gay nightclub in Orlando, Florida, and killed 49 people. It was the deadliest terrorist attack in the United States since September 11, 2001. In a 911 call just after the attack began, Mateen claimed allegiance to the Islamic State. Afterwards, Donald Trump criticized President Obama for failing to call the attack, quote, radical Islamic terrorism, close quote. Trump also fine-tuned his call for a ban on Muslim immigrants, even though Omar Mateen was an American-born U.S. citizen. Orlando, San Bernardino, Paris, all were perpetrated by people who called themselves Muslim. We're still waiting to hear who was responsible for the attacks yesterday at the Atatürk Airport in Istanbul, but ISIS is the prime suspect. With these tragedies as a backdrop, the inflammatory anti-Muslim rhetoric that has marked this presidential election cycle has fallen on some welcome ears. Hate crimes against Muslims are up, and it has become more acceptable to publicly denigrate Islam. How old is this distrust of Islam? Can a religion be inherently violent? Where are we headed as a nation on this front? My guest today will help us answer questions like these. Todd Green is author of The Fear of Islam, An Introduction to Islamophobia in the West. He's joining us from the studios of Minnesota Public Radio in Rochester. He is associate professor of religion at Luther College in Decorah, Iowa. Todd Green, welcome to Midday.
Sheila, thank you for having me.
I'm very, very glad you could join us. With me here in the studio is Homaira Ziad, the scholar of Islam at the Institute for Islamic, Christian, and Jewish Studies in Baltimore. Good to see you again, Homaira.
It's a pleasure to be here, Sheila.
Thanks for being here. Todd Green, let's start with the basics. What is, in your view, what is Islamophobia?
Well, the basic definition of Islamophobia is an irrational fear, hostility, or hatred toward Muslims or Islam. So it's about attitudes towards Muslims and about the religion of Islam, but it's also about actions. It can be exclusionary and discriminatory practices aimed at Muslims. So belief and attitudes as well as actions.
And where are we now with it? Is it really worse than it's ever been in this country?
Unfortunately, yes, absolutely. This is as worse as it's been since 9/11. 4 years ago in the last presidential election cycle, I thought it was really bad then, and I didn't think it could get much worse. But without a doubt, by pretty much every measure, whether it's hate crimes or proposed legislation or political rhetoric and the media and whatnot, all measures indicate a sharp rise in Islamophobia, and particularly the past year. The past year has just been brutal for Muslims in terms of being targeted for hate crimes, singled out in political discourse as sort of the ultimate other. And this is true both in Europe and in the United States.
The ultimate other was a phrase you just used, right? I wanted to pick up on that. Homaira Ziad, how would you describe Islamophobia in the U.S. right now?
Well, again, echoing Todd, Islamophobia functions across our nation in multiple different levels. It's multi-layered. So we know, for example, when we look at hate crimes in this country against Muslims, after 9/11, there were probably about 100 hate crimes annually against Muslims. Before 9/11, there were about 30. We have seen that in 2015 has been the worst year since 9/11, since the Paris attacks, since San Bernardino, since Trump really doubled down on this idea of banning Muslims from the country. During the course of 2015, there were 174 reported incidents of anti-Muslim violence, and this includes murders, this includes threats to life and property, this includes arsons, this includes threats, vandalism. So yes, we've seen that in the level of hate crimes. We've also seen, again, the level of discourse has deteriorated. Political discourse, the Republican candidates have been taking pot shots at the Muslim community throughout this whole presidential race. They have, as Todd said, become the ultimate other, again, which we should fear. And they're used to justify exclusionary measures. They're used to justify anti-immigrant measures. Muslims are used to justify the closing of our borders.
I'd like to play a clip from an interview on Fox News, Fox and Friends, from last December 8th. This was after the attack in San Bernardino, before some of the other things that have happened in the presidential race that you talked about, certainly before the shooting in Orlando. The voice that you'll hear is attorney John Hajar, co-chair of the American Middle East Coalition for Democracy. President Obama had just urged Americans not to succumb to Islamophobia.
He always is trying to find victimhood status for various groups, and in this case, Muslim Americans. You know, we are a welcoming country. Middle East Americans have been coming to the United States for 125 years and relatively incident-free. They have excelled in all fields of endeavor, from medicine, law, sports, business, entertainment. And America has been a very gracious and welcoming environment for people from the Middle East, and that continues to this day. And Islamophobia is really nothing but a myth.
Humairza Ziad, how do you respond to someone like John Hajar, who says, I don't see it. I see a welcoming country.
Mm-hmm. I would really push back against that. There are, you know, I've realized often in my educational career, in the career that I used to educate others about structural racism, about Islamophobia, that often their Islamophobia or even other forms of structural racism are so pervasive, they're so deeply embedded in people's consciousness, that sometimes it takes a little nudge to say, look, open your eyes and see what you imagine to be normal is actually deeply abnormal, is actually impacting the lives of communities all across the nation. So I would push back against that and say, look at the way that our media looks at instances of terror or violence committed by Muslims, as opposed to terror or violence committed by other types of groups, whether they're right-wing white supremacist groups, whether they're Christian evangelical groups. Let's look at that. Let's look at the way that crimes and violence committed by Muslims is given disproportionate attention in our media and disproportionate attention in our political discourse. Let's look at the way that so many states being pushed by anti-Muslim agendas, politicians, interest groups, have passed or have proposed to pass bills, anti-Sharia bills, right? Bills that say that foreign law cannot be practiced on in American lands. And what is that? Again, there's no danger of any kind of Islamic law coming into these spaces. These are more fear tactics. These are tactics meant to draw attention to Muslims as the ultimate other, Muslims whose values are inherently at odds with the American democratic pluralist system. So we can point to so many instances of rampant Islamophobia around this country that it'll be very hard for me to give any credence to this statement.
That is Humairza Ziad, the scholar of Islam at the Institute for Islamic Christian and Jewish Studies here in Baltimore, here on Midday, WYPR. I'm Sheila Cast. Joining us by phone from Rochester, Minnesota, is Todd Green, author of The Fear of Islam, An Introduction to Islamophobia in the West. You can be part of this conversation. Are you Muslim? Have you ever felt like people treated you differently because of your faith? Have you felt the pressure of some kind of Islamophobia? We'd love to hear what your experience is. You can call us at 410-662-8780, or you can send an email to midday@wypr.org. Todd Green, is it accurate that Muslims in this country have been relatively successful economically, as John Hajar suggests?
Right. There was a partial truth there that compared particularly to Europe, for example, Muslims have succeeded more economically, and Muslim communities in the United States are tend to be more middle class, better educated. In fact, the average Muslim American is better educated than the average non-Muslim American. In Europe, this would be sort of the other way around, where Muslims tend to be at the bottom of the socioeconomic ladder. So there are some differences across the Atlantic. But that aside, that does not take into account many of the things Humairza just talked about, things that we could explore in great depth. Surveillance programs, NYPD surveillance, NSA surveillance, FBI entrapment, at least there's been accusations of that. We've had a registration system in place. We, you know, we can talk about Donald Trump's proposal for, to register Muslims, but in 2002, the National Security Entry Exit Registration System was put in place and overseen by the Department of Homeland Security specifically to keep, you know, have surveillance of Muslims entering the country, non-immigrant Muslims. We have these huge spikes in hate crimes, you know, which the Fox News guest didn't even point to. Anti-Islam legislation, I can think of 10 states that have passed some form of anti-Islam legislation, mostly trying to target this non-existent threat of Sharia law. Opposition to the building of mosque or desecration of mosque. I've even now been tracking the past year opposition to cemeteries when Muslim communities tried to buy land and establish a cemetery. You know, now we're in a situation where it's not only the living Muslims that seem to be a threat, but the dead ones too. And this is how bad it's gotten. So there are all sorts of measures to point to Islamophobia, but there is also a very strong industry, this professional Islamophobia industry, that goes out of its way to dehumanize and demonize Muslims, and they profit considerably from it.
Explain that. When you call it an industry, okay, people sell books. People sell books on all sides of this issue. I see, you know, some profit moving there, but you seem to be describing something wider than that. In what way is this a profitable industry?
Yeah, I'm talking about a network of individuals and organizations. Some of them are politicians. They're bloggers, authors. Some of them claim to have sort of pseudo status as scholars, but all that they do from the time they wake up and to the time they go to bed each day is figure out how to demonize Muslims better today than they did yesterday. And their very existence, their very careers, these very organizations depend upon that message. It's not just a component of what they do. It's at the heart of what they do. These are people like Pamela Geller, who is one of the bloggers who brought to national attention in 2010 the proposed Islamic Center in Lower Manhattan. We wouldn't have debated that probably without Pamela Geller entering into the fray and trying to paint this in some sort of worst-case scenario of Islam taking over America and desecrating holy ground and sacred ground and that sort of thing. But when we're talking about this industry, we're talking about, according to a recent report that the Council on American Islamic Relations published called Confronting Fear, we're talking about a core of about 33 anti-Muslim groups, I mean, whose focus is to demonize Muslims. And according to that report, some $206 million in total revenue generated by or received by these groups between 2008 and 2013. So this is a very profitable industry who has really, all of whom have really gone a long way to contributing to this discourse in which Islam and Muslims are public enemy number one.
Homera?
Yes, I just wanted to piggyback and talk about that report, which Todd just did. You know, these groups, especially these 33 groups who have access to $206 million of money in the last 4 years, really make it the kind of actions that they do significantly threaten Muslim lives. That is, for example, one group, Act for America, under Brigitte Gabriel. They actually have something called a radicalization map locator, where this is for anyone to access, where they are able to show the addresses of every Muslim student association around the country, the locations, a number of mosques and Islamic center, and they're all cited as suspected national security concerns. So again, this discourse that says that anything related to Islam or the practice of Islam is inherently a national security concern, and then putting those kinds of that kind of information out into the public, and then inciting people to go and take action. So we see what we've seen recently is action, again, really unfortunate action by citizen militias who pick up guns and actually stand in front of mosques and Islamic schools armed to protest the presence of Muslims. So this is really inflicting harm on Muslim bodies, this industry, as Todd mentioned.
We need to take a short break here. There's obviously lots more to talk about, more about the uneasy relationship the West has and continues to have with Islam and the way it is playing out in some of these ways. You can join our conversation. Do you have questions about Islam? Are you uneasy about Muslims in your community? Give us a call at 410-662-8780. If you want to discuss this, send us an email at midday@wypr.org. I'm Sheila Cast. Stay with us. Welcome back to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking today about the fear of Islam in this country and other Western nations. My guests are Todd Green, author of The Fear of Islam, An Introduction to Islamophobia in the West, and Homaira Ziad, scholar of Islam at the Institute for Islamic Christian and Jewish Studies. We welcome you to be part of this conversation. We're interested in your experiences. If you are Muslim, whether the pressures that we're talking about, the hostility that we're talking about is something that you experience, give us a call at 410-662-8780 or send an email to midday@wypr.org. Thomas has phoned us from Baltimore. Thomas, welcome to Midday.
Thank you.
Your question or your comment?
Well, my comment is I've been a psychotherapist for the last 21 years, and we need to use the word phobia correctly. Phobia is an intense or irrational fear of something that poses little danger. So when somebody says they're Islamophobic, that's really a misuse of the term. The term would mean they have fear or they're overgeneralizing. But for instance, an irrational fear of flying would be no matter what safety records are presented or what proof you might be able to alter, a person has a very overwhelming response.
So are you, Thomas, is your point that this trend that we've been discussing is not intense enough to qualify as a phobia?
Yes, that's my point. And though there may be somebody who actually, there may be a group of people that experience an actual phobia or homophobia or Islamophobia, it's such a loaded term that you've taken away the person's free will. You're basically saying like a hate crime. They're so driven by their emotions, they're incapable of an irrational response. It's actually very demeaning to people to suggest that they're completely driven by their emotions. It's not the case, and I've treated many, many people for fear of flying, and I have very experienced treating anxiety disorders.
Thomas, I appreciate your raising the question. Todd Green, since your book is titled The Fear of Islam, An Introduction to Islamophobia in the West, let me ask how you would respond to Thomas's point that a phobia is a more intense psychological situation.
Well, there's two sort of responses I have. First, it's the word that has developed over the past couple of decades to as a label for this particular type of prejudice. Is it a perfect word? I don't think it's a perfect word any more than anti-Semitism is a perfect word, because not all people of a Semitic background are Jewish. But anti-Semitism has come to be a word that we use to target hostility towards Jews or Judaism and that sort of thing. So there can be a legitimate debate over that, but it is the war that has developed, and the language is a little bit malleable in this case, and whether it meets a clinical definition. But I would push back on the caller's suggestion that that this is not necessarily driven by a lack of a reason, that this is an emotional sort of response. I don't think there is a lot of rational, measured conversation in the United States today about Islam and Muslims, and many attitudes that the non-Muslim majority have, and much of the discourse that we encounter in the public about Muslims actually is not based upon reason or facts, and oftentimes it is very much an emotional reaction. So part of what I try to do in combating Islamophobia is trying to help contextualize what we know about Muslims and what we know about Islam. And trying to sort of bring a more human face to the Muslim community. But we also simply know that a lot of this fear, in my sort of analysis of it, is driven by a lack of relationships between Muslims and the non-Muslim majority, And when you don't have those relationships, you don't have context, you don't have actual firsthand knowledge of Muslims, then the kinds of things that we heard from the Fox News guest that you played earlier sort of fill in that vacuum. So I do believe a lot of the reactions and the conversations and debates in the public sphere and political proposals by Donald Trump and Ted Cruz are very much driven by an irrational fear. I will stand by that.
Thomas, again, I appreciate the call. Raquel has phoned us from Baltimore. Raquel, welcome to Midday.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate you having me on the show, and I really like the topic. I'm married to a Moroccan-American who's Muslim, and I am not a practicing Muslim, but we do raise our son in the faith. And I just wanted to give a really simple example of how this impacts our life on a daily basis. We're unable to watch with our son news programs, local news, or such as CNN news, because it's just not explicable how often and how frequent similar images of Muslims are repeated over and over. And I think for some people that don't live in a Muslim household, they might not really reflect on that. But especially during a month like Ramadan, where we're really taking a more peaceful approach to the way we're living day to day and a mindful approach, it's very upsetting to not be able to just turn on the television or even listen to the radio in some sense, because the messages are so negative. And it's not really something you can explain to a seven-year-old why this strong repetition is over and over and over and over being replayed on our media.
Raquel, I appreciate your making that point. Homer, how would you respond to that?
Raquel, thank you for that point. I would say Raquel's experience and the experience of her family mirrors the experience of so many Muslims living in this country today, that they are afraid of the ways in which their religion is being characterized in the public square and how that's going to, that kind of psychic impact that will have on their children to be othered in such a way. Look, going back to the earlier caller, you know, I really stand, it's fascinating that the definition he gave for phobia, the intense or irrational fear of something that poses little danger, is exactly what is happening, in fact, in the public square. So if we're, and you know, having been an educator in so many non-Muslim contexts for so long, I see exactly a pervasive emotional knee-jerk response around issues to do with Islam that are present even in liberal communities. That is, communities who would normally never say anything about a religious tradition or a culture or a race in any kind of essentialist way will do so with Islam. That Islam is uniquely or essentially misogynist, uniquely or essentially violent, uniquely or essentially driven by, or Muslims are uniquely and essentially driven by religion first and foremost, or if not only. So it is an intense irrational fear. It plays out in our media. It plays out in our discourse. And one point I want to make is that Muslims, again, why is this something that poses little danger? When we actually look at global terrorism statistics, when we look at terrorism in our nation, we see that between the years of 2004 and 2013, 36 Americans were killed by terrorism committed by Muslims. 36 Americans. I mean, think of that and think how often we hear about Muslim or Islamist terrorism, quote unquote, versus 370,000 by gun violence. Now, that those are numbers you place in front of someone. Those are facts. Those are absolute facts. Now, when we look at something like Orlando, yes, of course, there is rampant homophobia in Muslim communities. And I would be the first to say we need to address that very deeply. But when we look at the way that Islam is used as a red herring post-Orlando, turning away from issues like gun control, turning away from issues like rampant homophobia in Christian communities in the U.S. that sponsored 200 bills that went to state legislatures to try to discriminate against LGBTQ people in the U.S. So again, Islam is a red herring is a really important thing to keep in mind. We see this over and over and over again to try to distract us from the issues we ought to really be concerned with, access to guns, and really, and the violence that we should be concerned about, white supremacist, neo-Nazi, Christian supremacist violence in the United States that is rampant and that we need to address and check. Again, do we need to talk about Muslim violence? Yes, we do. But so much is it's egregious.
This is Midday on WYPR. I'm Sheila Cass speaking with Homaira Ziad, who is the scholar of Islam at the Institute for Islamic Christian and Jewish Studies in Baltimore, and with Todd Green, author of The Fear of Islam, An Introduction to Islamophobia in the West. You can join this conversation, as many people have. Call us at 410-662-8780 or send an email to midday@wypr.org. Rich is phoning us from Baltimore. Rich, welcome to the show.
Hi, how you doing? I just wanted to make a point. Kind of first, you know, I grew up in the 60s, and, you know, I can't tell you how many times I've watched over the media where you see people in Muslim countries burning the flag, burning effigies of our president, you know, and that's something that I've seen pretty much all my life. So, you know, I guess some of the Muslimophobia, you know, Islamophobia has come from that. But, you know, and even as far as close as, you know, Ahmadinejad was president, even though he's not, but we watched these massive meetings with the public where they would talk about wiping Israel off the face of the earth and wiping America off the face of the earth. And this is just a few years ago. So I just think, you know, these are the kind of mindsets, you know, someone who's grown up in that country, grown up in that feeling of hate against America, you know, how can we bring them over here and accept them to just accept us and become part of our country? You know, I think that's where a lot of the phobia comes from. And when it comes to the terrorism acts, you never see any of the mullahs or any of the acting governments of these countries ever denouncing. You know, all we ever see really is celebrations when something horrible happens to something in our country. Like 9/11, you saw celebrations. And those are the kinds of things that we're used to seeing in the media. And it just seems to me that the only ones that are asking us to accept this is media in our country. That in their own countries, they're celebrating these terrorist acts and celebrating hating America by burning flags and all these other things.
So, Rich, you're pointing specifically to actions overseas, not to Muslim actions in America that you say make you worry about Islam.
Well, my point is, if you stand two Muslims next to each other, and one wants to kill Americans and the other one loves Americans, there's no way to tell the difference. And you say, okay, we'll just have to see which one is going to blow up a building and see which one is going to work and support their family and become part of this country. It's so difficult to discriminate.
Let me let our guest respond. Homaira, do you want to respond to Rich?
Yes, to parts of what Rich said. Rich, I absolutely hear what you're saying. And again, there are several things that come up here. This is a multi-layered response. One is that we really need to make sure that we don't conflate the global with the local. So overwhelmingly, the surveys around Muslims in the United States and their attitudes towards citizenship, their attitudes towards violence, have shown over and over again that the vast majority of Muslims in the United States are here to seek a good life, to raise their children, to be American citizens, and in fact, they do consistently and constantly denounce the violence that is happening in the name of Islam. You say that you don't see this in the media, and I feel you, because neither do I. But it is there. It is there in alternative media. It is there. If one knows where to look, it is there, and it is loud, and it is clear, and it is almost constant. One of the things, again, this is a vast and complex question, but yes, there is a lot of anger against the United States in many Muslim majority nations and in many nations around the world that aren't Muslim. And that has a lot to do, on the one hand, yes, it has to do with demagogues and politicians that fan the flames of hatred against the United States and hatred against Israel as red herrings, right? As we tend to do in our country as well. But on the other hand, this really, you need to take into account the fact that the United States has consistently intervened against democracy and on the behalf of authoritarianism in Muslim-majority areas around the world. And in fact, the reputation that the United States has in so many Muslim-majority nations is that the U.S. cares only about itself and that the U.S. will intervene in any way possible to destroy the democratic aspirations of countries like Iran, countries like Pakistan, countries like Yemen, if U.S. interests are at stake. So keep that in mind. These conversations are very much political, and they very much have to do with the history of U.S. interventionism in the Middle East for our own political, military, and our oil interests.
Todd Green, our caller Rich, in part raised a question of what people hear in the media. How much of what you see as a problem of Islamophobia do you lay at the feet of the coverage?
The coverage has not been great within the mainstream media when it comes to stories of Islam and stories of Muslims. In fact, most critical media studies that sort of track this coverage usually come up with the same findings. I can think of one study from an organization called Media Tenor that found in the year 2013 that 3/4 of U.S. media coverage was negative of Islam and primarily focused on violence and terrorism. Another study came out last year by a Toronto-based firm studying the New York Times, you know, the so-called progressive newspaper, and found that the New York Times portrays Islam and Muslims more negatively than alcohol, cancer, and cocaine, right? In terms of the headlines, in terms of the actual stories. So the mainstream media does have a big role in this, particularly since we have to keep in mind a couple of things, one of which is about 2/3 of the American population do not personally know a Muslim. Okay, so the only Muslim they know are the Muslims they see on cable news. So if you're watching CNN yesterday, the only Muslims you might know are the Muslims you saw on the videotapes in the Istanbul airport. So that's a problem. And most Americans admit that they have little to no knowledge of Islam. So if they don't know much about Islam, they don't know any Muslims, the media plays a primary role then in filling that void. So it is very fair, I think, to criticize the media in this. That said, I do need to note that in the past year, I have been pleased to see that the media has a little bit more often than in the past been willing to tackle the topic of Islamophobia, hence the program we're doing today, to use the word Islamophobia. About a year ago, I could not pay a mainstream journalist to use that word. But now I'm hearing it a bit more. I heard it from Secretary Clinton yesterday in a talk that she gave. So at least the name is being used and journalists are starting to tackle that. And I do appreciate that. I do want to add on this topic of Muslims denouncing terrorism, which I think is connected to the media, that I wish the media would cover more of that too. So the caller hasn't heard any Muslim scholars denouncing terrorism, and some of that is due to the lack of media coverage. And yeah, you know, if you know who to follow on Twitter, it's not hard to find these condemnations. I have collected these statements on my book's website, thefearofislam.com, and you can go on there, and one of those pages has a long list of condemnations and links to condemnations. But the larger question and a more uncomfortable question I want to ask to listeners today, and this goes beyond the media, is in the age of the internet, it would take you about 20 seconds to Google Muslims condemning terrorism and get a list of hits of websites that have these statements. So when someone says, I've never heard Muslims condemning terrorism, and they haven't even taken the opportunity to Google it and find those condemnations very apparent and oftentimes on prominent websites, released in press releases, then the burden falls on the rest of us. Why don't we know that?
And on that challenge, we're going to take another quick break here. Lots more to talk about, and I'm hoping our callers will stay with us. We will continue taking your calls when we come back. We're talking about Islamophobia. You can send an email to midday@wypr.org or phone us at 410-662-8780. I'm Sheila Cass. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cast. If you're just joining us, we're talking this hour about what seems to be the growing anxiety around Islam in this country. I'm speaking with Todd Green, Associate Professor of Religion at Luther College in Iowa, who's written a book, The Fear of Islam, An Introduction to Islamophobia in the West. Also with me here in the studio is Homaira Ziad, the scholar of Islam at the Institute for Islamic, Christian, and Jewish Studies. In Baltimore. You can be part of this conversation. Send an email to midday@wypr.org or phone us 410-662-8780. Jonathan has called us from Parkville. Jonathan, welcome to Midday.
Hey, good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call. It was difficult for me to listen to the last caller's comments, but I can understand where he's coming from, sort of just in terms of being anxious about terrorism in this country, because this media, our media certainly does promulgate a lot of sort of hateful messages. He mentioned placing two Muslims next to each other. Well, I can do that and just think of two Muslims who I know. One was a very close friend of mine who sort of stood with me against bullies and was just a kind soul all through middle school. And I can think of another one, and she was kind enough to host my last birthday party. So when I think of praying to Muslims next to each other, that's sort of the comparison that I, or that's sort of the thought that I think of. I just sort of like, which one has been more gracious to me as just sort of a white guy living in Maryland? And that's my thought. Now, on the topic of the media, what I am the professor mentioned earlier, the issue of red herrings constantly bringing up, or red herrings in the media that sort of overplay the issue of Islamist terrorism.
Jonathan, have we lost you? So, Todd Green, how would you respond to Jonathan's point? It seems to underscore part of what you were saying about the importance of actually knowing people who practice Islam.
Personal relationships make all the difference in the world. It's a Pew research study that revealed that about two-thirds of Americans don't personally know a Muslim. But if you dig into that study, and I think that study came out in 2014, you find something else that's interesting that confirms that point I'm trying to make, and that's that if you know someone of a religious tradition different than your own, you're much more likely to have a positive view of that tradition. If I know someone who is Jewish, I'm much more likely to have a very positive feeling about Judaism and much less likely to be anti-Semitic. Same with Mormons, same with Muslims, right? So the personal relationships break down barriers, they break down prejudices, and they give us some context, right? This idea that Muslims are inherently prone to violence, which is sort of so prominent in public discourse, it's easy to think that when you don't actually know any Muslims, right? Or the only Muslims you know are the ones you see when the media is covering stories of terrorism. But if you have personal relationships with Muslims in your day-to-day life, it makes a big difference. And that's why when people ask me, how do we combat Islamophobia, the number one thing I say is relationships, 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 and it, which take time, and we need to invest more in that. And Muslims and non-Muslims need to do more to build those bridges. But relationships matter, and your caller verified that in his own experience.
Charlotte has called us from Lutherville with, I think, another take on this. Charlotte, welcome to Midday.
Yes, hello.
Hello.
Can you hear me?
Yes, we hear you fine.
Okay, wonderful. Yes, I live in Lutherville. I am Jewish. My husband's a Muslim from Jordan. And we live in a predominantly Christian neighborhood. And although we've lived there for 2 years, we're the first ones out there to help with the snow removal, especially with elderly people. We are the ones with the organic garden that's giving away the fruits and vegetables, especially to elderly people on a fixed income. And I find that a lot of our neighbors are too afraid to ask us the basic questions. And too often, it's a fairly conservative neighborhood. They hide behind the Trump mantra and stuff, and their only questions are, which country is my husband from, as opposed to, look at our fresh strawberries that we are willing to give with you. So I find that although we are doing above and beyond to reach out to these friends and neighbors, that it's often we give more than what we receive.
Charlotte, thank you for that insight. Homaira, this Charlotte seems to be saying that people don't necessarily take advantage of being in touch with someone who practices Islam to learn something about it.
Yeah, I think Charlotte brings up a great point. You know, one of the reasons why the institute that I work for was set up was that, you know, relationships, I agree with Todd, absolutely, that relationships are integral, but integral to knowing more about each other. But relationships often tend to skate over some of the more contentious issues around our religious identity, our political identities. And often we need to, as a society, we need to create spaces where individuals can come, safe spaces where people can come create relationships with each other around issues that are deeply contentious, around issues on which we differ, whether it's racial difference, religious difference, a political difference. We need more spaces, and I think our younger generations, our millennials, are creating those spaces all around the nation because they understand that just knowing someone doesn't mean that you will dispel any prejudice about them. Even being a neighbor with someone doesn't mean that you don't harbor certain suspicions, certain misunderstandings about their deepest core beliefs and what drives them to work in this world.
Short of actually taking part in, you know, in a meeting or something more formal, I mean, is there a way that you have found to broach that between neighbors? Is there a way that you have found to start a good conversation that doesn't send people back into their corners?
I do have to.
It's hard.
It's hard, which is why spaces need to be created. It is hard. I mean, there are, you know, I've heard of friendships, long friendships, dissolving over the inability to be able to talk about our deepest differences, which is, again, I need to impress the fact that we do need to create those spaces, and also to say that we need, that all of these things need time. These kinds of excavations of our deepest differences are not things that happen overnight. These are sustained and committed conversations. And I think friends can do that. I mean, again, we've seen, you know, Three Amigos or the three women, Jewish, Christian, and Muslim, who have published a book, who as friends began to create those spaces over coffee to talk about their deepest differences. They as friends created safe spaces to talk about these things, and then they began doing so in other communities. But it's a commitment.
I want to pull Khalid into this conversation. He's calling us from Baltimore. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Happy to be on the show. I'm going to try not to be too long-winded, but I'm an African-American Muslim, and the Black Muslim community descendant of the Nation of Islam is, I mean, the only homegrown Muslim community that I'm aware of in this country. And like from that perspective, Islamophobia isn't about the religion so much it is about racism, which is the biggest issue that this country has faced since its inception. The one caller a few calls ago made the comment that if you put two Muslims next to each other, you don't know, you know, who has ill intent. And I mean, what do two Muslims look like? I am African American, 6'3" with dreadlocks. Like, nobody looks at me and thinks that I'm a Muslim, even though I have in my whole life, and, you know, am an active practicer. I think the biggest issue is that we need to, yes, talk to people, but also I think it's on the onus of non-Muslims, more so than Muslims, to get to know Muslims and get to know the truth about Islam and the people who are and are not Muslims.
Khalid, thank you for raising this. Todd Green, pick up on Khalid's point. African-American Muslims are the homegrown Muslim community in this country. How much of what we've been talking about, are they subject to the same prejudice, or is it a different dynamic that's going on with African-American Muslims?
No, I think Khalid made a great point and a very important one, and several things come to mind. First, that oftentimes when the stereotype of Muslims we have here in the United States is of people with an Arab background, Arab equals Muslim, right, which is his own form of racism. But in the process, we disregard and we silence the voices of African-American Muslims, and that's very important to lift that up. And I would love to see, when the media reaches out to various members of the Muslim community, I'd love to see the media reach out more to African-American Muslims than they currently do. African-American Muslims roughly make up about a third of the Muslim community here in the United States.
And the Muslim community in the U.S. is about how large as a percentage of the U.S. population?
1 to 2%, depends on the poll you look at. Not much, but around 1 to 2%, anywhere between 3 and 7 million people. But it's the most racially one of the most racially diverse religious communities in the United States, and that's important to keep in mind. And it's also important, I think Khalid made this point, and it does correct a point from a caller earlier, one of the callers who asked about, you know, how do we accept Muslims coming over here if we see all this anti-Americanism abroad? That assumes, of course, that all the Muslims who are here just showed up, all right? In fact, Islam has been as a part of the American cultural and landscape since, its earliest days. There were Muslim slaves who were brought over in the Atlantic slave trade. So Islam has been around a very, very long time. It didn't just emerge in the 1950s or 1960s. And the final thing I want to say to affirm Khalid's call is that he talks about the onus being on non-Muslims, and I do make that point quite a bit. It's provocative, but I do make the case that it's the non-Muslim majority that has the primary burden of combating Islamophobia. And I try to tell Muslim communities when I speak with them, Islamophobia is not your fault. I would never walk into a synagogue and tell folks gathered at the synagogue that, you know, here's anti-Semitism and fighting that. That's primarily your job. It's not primarily the job of Jews to fight anti-Semitism. It's the rest of us. Islamophobia is not really the study of Islam. It's the study of bigotry or hostility towards Muslims in Islam. So I try to convince people that when I study Islamophobia, I'm not first and foremost studying Muslim communities. I'm studying the rest of us. I'm studying people like me.
We are down to just less than 2 minutes, Homaira, so I'll give you the last word. If you can give us some sense of where we're headed or how you see this unfolding.
Yes, I mean, I think I really want to touch again on what Khalid said, in that there is a strong intersectionality in all of these justice issues. So, there is a conversation that is happening in Black Lives Matter that is extremely relevant and central to issues of Islamophobia. The violence that is being committed against Black bodies is deeply significant for and is very much a part of this conversation around the violence that's happening to Muslim bodies. I think, again, millennials understand this. Millennials see that these are all different forms of structural racism within our society. And again, while Islamophobia has a particularly religious element to it, meaning a fear, an irrational fear of Islam, there are deep, deep elements of racism in this, of people who look different than us, of people who are brown or black or different. And I think that we need to support and encourage these justice movements that take seriously the question of intersectionality.
I really appreciate both of you discussing this with us. There's lots more we could talk about and probably should someday, but I think you've given us a lot to think about. I'm sorry to the callers that we didn't get to, because you were raising great questions also. I want to thank you, Homaira Ziad, Scholar of Islam at the Institute for Islamic, Christian, and Jewish Studies here in Baltimore. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Sheila.
And Todd Green, author of The Fear of Islam, An Introduction to Islamophobia in the West, Associate Professor of Religion at Luther College in Iowa. Thank you.
Thank you, Sheila.
And thank you for listening. Lunch for our midday guests was provided by Dangerously Delicious Pies, with locations at 2839 O'Donnell Street on the square in Canton and 810 West 36th Street in Hamden. Their menu includes a variety of homemade sweet and savory pies and quiches. And thank you for listening. Tune in tomorrow. Recent reports suggest that diet plays a more important role in weight loss than exercise, but there are lots of reasons to exercise beyond losing weight. We'll talk about a range from improving memory and sleep to warding off depression. I'm Sheila Cast. Have a great afternoon.
Midday is produced by Maureen Harvey and Andrea Appleton. The show is engineered by Luke Spicknall. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcasts and live streaming are available at wypr.org
or on demand using the WYPR app. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.